You're aware that we have a lineup of world-class speakers. I'm going to give very brief introductions because we have a whole section. You can read the bios in the back. We're moving now to the first session toward a comprehensive evangelical vision for peace. David Gushee will be our first speaker. He's a co-author of Kingdom Ethics, and I'd like to say a man of courage and ethical discernment, challenging the church and the U.S. government about torture right after 9/11. I was so privileged to work with him. Lisa Sharon Harper will be next. She's been a delightful partner in preparation for this conference. She's a co-author of Left and Right. Jeff Tunnicliffe is the CEO of a World Evangelical Alliance that represents over 600 million. I think they're saying 650 million now. So he specializes in herding cats, you know, the challenge of working with networks and evangelicals all over the world. And I so appreciate Jeff because he has had a vision for peace much sooner than most evangelicals, and I'm privileged to work with him. Kate Gould is the lead lobbyist in the Middle East policy issues for a Quaker-based group called Friends Committee on National Legislation. Let's hear it for David Gushee as he begins our conference. Thank you.
I brought 100 copies of my paper, and are they being distributed around? All right, so go ahead and pass those around. Thank you very much, Sarah. Rick, thank you for, where'd you go? Okay, thank you for your vision and organizing this conference. Thanks to all of you for being here. 100 copies may not be enough. I know that makes Rick very, very happy. So we have a very brief amount of time, and so I'll try to be concise. Let me say that when I graduated from college in 1984, I gave a speech in which I said, I'm not sure our generation will live out its days. I was concerned about nuclear weapons, still am concerned about nuclear weapons. So I've been thinking about peace and war and nuclear issues in particular for almost 30 years. And so as I was given this assignment, I thought, what new thing do I have to say? So I just decided to kind of think from the ground up about what I'm going to call the U.S. warfare state and evangelical peacemaking. I'm going to try to do three things during this talk: to offer an accurate critical assessment in sketch form of contemporary U.S. foreign and military policy, that's all. To offer an accurate critical assessment of contemporary evangelical engagement with same, and to suggest some ways forward. Because time is so brief, I am mainly going to state my points in the form of propositions. Boom, 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 through the list, peaceably, of course. And then see what kind of conversation this evokes. I recognize that what I have to say at various points will offend, but that's kind of how you have a conversation about things from the ground up. You have to think about everything, and so that's what I'm trying to do here. So, first point, the leaders of the federal government of the United States have in the past 12 years proven unable or unwilling to pass anything approaching a balanced budget. Sometimes they can't pass any budget at all. As annual deficits and cumulative debts mount, concern about our dramatic fiscal irresponsibility has moved to the center of political debate, with legitimate fears of a coming fiscal collapse as retiring baby boomer Social Security and health benefits costs kick in. Zbigniew Brzezinski has recently argued that the ineffectiveness of our legislative process in addressing this basic task of governance is contributing to a weakening respect for the United States abroad, which is itself an important foreign policy concern. We can't seem to get our own house in order. And yet, amidst these fiscal problems, our $775 billion annual defense budget, not to mention our tens of billions of dollars spent on intelligence and other national security expenses, is treated as sacrosanct. Budget cutters, especially on the Republican side, but also on the Democratic side often, do not train their sights on the defense and intelligence budget much as they seek to address our flood of red ink, but instead focus on dramatic cuts in the safety net for the poor. According to former Reagan budget director David Stockman, our $775 billion defense budget is nearly twice as large, adjusted for inflation, as the defense budget of Dwight Eisenhower in 1961 during the Cold War. Our fiscal year 2011 defense budget was five times greater than that of China, our nearest competitor, constituted over 40% of the world's entire military spending, and was larger than the cumulative defense budget of the next 14 nations in the top 15. All of this comes at a time when our infrastructure is crumbling, our schools are sliding, and one-sixth of our population cannot find or has stopped looking for full-time work. David Stockman, I put this up here again because the numbers are so staggering, suggests that no plausible national defense goals today justify this level of defense spending. He rightly points out that, quote, we have no advanced industrial state enemies akin to the USSR of the Cold War. He argues that what in fact supports a budget of this size is an ideology of neoconservative imperialism and an attempt to function as a global policeman even after the world has fired us from this role. Do you notice who I'm quoting? Some of you will remember some of these names: Zbigniew Brzezinski, hawk in the Carter years, David Stockman, Reagan-era budget director. That's intentional, okay? Andrew Basevich, how does he say his name? Basevich? Argues in several important recent books that the direction of U.S. foreign and military policy is slipping from democratic control. It is instead dominated by a cohort of active and retired military, intelligence, law enforcement, corporate, lobbyist, academic, and political elites whose power in Washington is sufficiently impressive as to foreclose serious reconsideration of what he calls the Washington rules. The elites enforcing these rules consistently drive us to policies of permanent war, a staggeringly large global military presence, and regular global interventionism. This analysis stands in striking continuity with the warnings offered by President Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex 50 years ago. This was in 1961. He said, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex, the Republican President Dwight Eisenhower. U.S. foreign and military policy is receiving scant attention in the 2012 presidential campaign, despite Governor Romney's efforts to position himself as more hawkish than President Obama, especially, for example, in relation to Israel. But I believe this will likely have little effect, largely because President Obama has learned the lesson of prior Democratic presidents and candidates that no Democrat can afford to seem soft on defense or weak on foreign policy. That is, that no one dare question the Washington rules. Thus, only more fringe politicians such as Ron Paul ever propose fundamental questions about the nature of our foreign and military policy. In a footnote, I said it's striking how much support Ron Paul got from younger voters and from military veterans. That was very interesting. Speaks to disquiet, sense of disestablishment there, like not being heard. While our taste for large boots-on-the-ground military interventions appears finally to have waned after the bloody and bankrupting off-budget wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our special forces, covert and technological intervention abroad, and the massive secret national security establishment that supports them has heightened. Our nation has not had a serious debate about the centralization of presidential authority involved in this recent shift, including the legitimacy of presidential authority to order long-distance drone strikes in countries that want such attention and in countries that don't. I believe that the United States remains a nation traumatized by 9/11, though I think there's a slight fade there. This year didn't seem quite as intense, perhaps, in the memory. I do believe we are easily manipulated into military and covert engagements in the name of post-9/11 national security. I think one of the greatest tragedies of the last decade has been the extraordinary burden borne by the small caste of soldiers who have been killed or traumatized by our recent wars. We honor them with sentimental displays at airports and ballparks, but seem to have no serious answer for mental health problems that now take 25 veterans' lives by suicide for every one soldier now dying on the battlefield. And we will be paying their pensions and medical expenses for the next 70 years. In a trenchant turn of phrase, David Stockman suggests that we have developed into a warfare state. not my language, his, whose military spending excesses are one major factor contributing to our economic decline and imminent fiscal emergency. I believe that David's document is correct, but I'd like to put his analysis and the, you know, other analysis on the table. So what about evangelicals, second part of my talk? I believe that this screen adequately depicts how much impact evangelical voices are having on U.S. foreign policy right now.
It's very true.
There is no, in my analysis, contemporary Christian leader, scholar, denomination, or movement whose views on U.S. foreign and military policy seem to matter to either party or its leaders. Just war theory does not seem to be functioning in any significant or constructive way. In academia, its use seems to have become an empty intellectual exercise, divorced from any persuasive power to guide either state policy or Christian practice. The outcome of just war reasoning seems tightly linked to the prior ideological or temperamental makeup of the just war theorist. On the right, anti-Muslim and neo-crusade thinking have resurfaced in both popular and academic circles, Christian and otherwise. This problem has obviously been exacerbated by the trauma of 9/11 and other acts of Islamist terrorism, as well as the stresses of multiple U.S. military engagements in primarily Muslim lands, but still, it's a deeply disturbing trend. The Crusades are in some circles. Pacifism remains popular in elite academic and popular progressive circles, but I believe it has little to offer to public discussion, discussion of the military budget and so on, other than sometimes quite trenchant analyses of obvious excesses or wrongs in U.S. foreign and military policy. And most academic pacifism is untethered to actual Christian communities that practice either nonviolence or any other form of radical Christian discipleship. Just peacemaking theory offers a profound strengthening of the last resort criterion of just war theory, as well as highlighting realistic conflict resolution possibilities through creative state and NGO diplomacy and grassroots citizen advocacy and action. And I honor my mentor, Glenn Stassen, for his creative pioneering efforts here. I believe just peacemaking theory is currently the most relevant of all existing Christian peacemaking approaches, but it would not be accurate, I believe, to say that it has gained wide influence in U.S. foreign policy circles. A long-standing coalition strategy that I've witnessed for about 30 years within the what I call the center-left of evangelicalism has attempted to overcome differences between pacifists and just warriors by emphasizing areas of agreement and shared commitment, sometimes to just peacemaking or other kinds of shared commitments. This has protected friendships and produced strategic gains at times, but I wonder whether it has weakened the concreteness, realism, and relevance of evangelical peacemaking efforts, perhaps obscuring the legitimate principal differences between pacifists and those who believe that Christians can sometimes support the use of force. So, last section, some ways forward. I'll make a couple points here. I think Christians, evangelicals, need to join the conversation about U.S. foreign and military policy priorities. That includes studying U.S. foreign policy goals, our current military presence around the world, our alliance commitments, existing and planned weapons systems, and finally, how all of that is reflected in the U.S. defense budget. We also need to become aware of the various political, civic, and economic forces that limit needed budget cuts in defense, even when foreign policy and governmental leaders don't even want certain programs or weapon systems. This is a formidable research agenda calling for the emergence of a new generation of ethics specialists in this area. Second, we need to offer our own proposals eventually, or join with those of others, for what kind of foreign policy and use of military force and size and shape of defense budget that we could support. But this would require a willingness on at least some of our parts to accept a legitimate national right of self-defense and use of lethal force under certain specified conditions. It would also involve consideration once again of the morality of maintaining military forces and weapons of sufficient scope to deter aggressors. In other words, we have to decide as evangelicals whether we believe there is such a thing as national security at all that can find a place within a Christian approach, and if so, how a legitimate national security is best protected. To do the above would involve accepting, at least provisionally, the stubborn existence of an entity called the nation state, in a world filled with an ever-shifting array of nation-states and the internationally recognized right of those states to defend themselves. That is one price of admission to the conversation about how much defense to buy, for what purposes, and so on. Currently in academia, I notice much critique of modernity, including the hegemony of the nation-state and its use of violence. This is interesting material, very interesting. But meanwhile, we do live in a world with 190-plus nation-states, including our own, all of which are committed to defending themselves. I suggest we need to swing back toward consideration of the difference between an ethic for Christian disciples and an ethic for the leaders of nations and states and political communities. The state is not the church. Even though I believe that the church as church is called to be a nonviolent community and to bear witness to nonviolence, the state as state cannot be a nonviolent community. Though it can be called to exercise its security responsibilities as nonviolently as possible, the church can urge peace. We can pioneer peacemaking practices. We can place ourselves at risk in order to create reconciliation opportunities between peoples and nations, and many do that. We must do that. But we must take seriously, once again, the classic conundrum that the statesperson, even the Christian statesperson, faces responsibilities involving the use of force in relation to protecting the people within their realm that others generally do not face. This is what U.S. military intelligence and diplomatic operatives do and are supposed to be doing, even if their current mission needs to be trimmed dramatically. Do I have time to tell my story here at the end? Is my time okay? Okay. I'll tell you a story. I was sitting in an airplane on a runway in Tel Aviv this summer, waiting for our plane to take off. We were at the point in the preparation for the flight when the attendants start telling passengers to power down their electronics. You know how it always takes several warnings. In this case, the young man next to me on the exit row kept defying these instructions. A flight attendant noticed and reminded him sternly to turn his phone off and put it away. As we were taxiing out to the runway, he slipped the phone out of his pocket and started messing with it again. This time, the flight attendant got out of her seat, stood right over the man, and officially threatened him with a $10,000 fine if the phone was not shut off and put away immediately. He complained about how he was finishing a conversation with his small son in Israel. The attendant was unmoved. Finally, he put the phone away. So what did I witness in this really quite striking moment? I witnessed the use of coercive power against a person whose behavior violated the law and was believed to pose a threat to the safety of others. Whether you believe that about cell phones or not, that's, you know, whatever. That's the law. Okay. All right. That's an illustration. It illustrates the power of the state through the designated airline authority to impose by coercion on this passenger a certain set of behavioral expectations. As I pondered the power of the state to take $10,000 away from my seatmate, I thought of other far more serious scenarios. What if this man had waited 30 minutes and instead of using a cell phone unlawfully, had rushed to the emergency exit right in front of us, we were on the emergency exit row, and tried to wrestle it open at 30,000 feet? Or what if he had tried to set off a bomb? There is something about the utter vulnerability of an airplane at 30,000 feet, especially after 9/11, that reminds us that there really is such a thing as a lethal threat against innocent people, and that the state really does have a responsibility to deter, prevent, and punish such threats. Indeed, the airplane scenario reminded me that it is actually the responsibility of any able-bodied person on an airplane to participate in that security project on that airplane, as has occurred several times in recent years. I reflected that if faced with the necessity of preventing someone from killing everyone on an airplane, it would be my moral obligation to do what I could to defend innocent life using the least violent means necessary. In Christian terms, to do so, to stop that man from rushing to the exit or setting off his shoe or whatever, would be an aspect of the love of neighbor commanded by Jesus, not a defiance of my Lord. That all crystallized for me on that airplane that day. Of course, being in Tel Aviv was relevant as well. Thinking about my recalcitrant seatmate helped me reconnect the use of force to the obligation to love my neighbor, which takes just war theory back to its roots, its best roots. I want to test a hypothesis with you in closing. What if the thinking of U.S. center-left Christians, including evangelicals, has been somewhat misshaped by the increasingly obvious wrongs of U.S. foreign and military policy for the last 65 years, including the use of nuclear weapons in 1945, the insane nuclear arms race with its mutually assured destruction, the deployment and planned use of nuclear weapons in various theaters of war, the foolish, conventional, but devastating wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and elsewhere, and the bloating of our military budget. What if, because U.S. foreign and military policy has been so potentially lethal to the planet, bankrupting, unwise, and neo-imperialistic, this reality has perhaps obscured for us historic issues in Christian thinking about war that go back at least as far as Ambrose? What if we simply haven't had to deal with the most basic and ancient questions about whether or how people on this planet legitimately defend their lives against aggressors? Because until the recent domestic terror attacks, this was not the most urgent question before us when thoughtful Christians engaged U.S. foreign policy. These are at least the questions raised for me as I consider the nexus between the U.S. warfare state and evangelical peacemaking. Thank you very much.